sound nobody hears. Don't think it brighter in the shine.
From WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, I'm Johannes Werner, and these are your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, March 18th. A divide is opening up across Florida law enforcement, and it's drawing national attention. Several Florida sheriffs are raising concerns about mass deportation policies promoted by the Trump and DeSantis administrations. Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd warned Monday during a State Immigration Enforcement Council meeting that the approach could strain local resources and damage trust within immigrant communities. Judd, a favorite of DeSantis, said he plans to draft a letter to Trump, the U.S. House Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader, urging better guidelines over which undocumented immigrants should be targeted for deportation. That pushback is notable, signaling a shift in how some local agencies view their role in immigration enforcement. At least six other Florida sheriffs are supporting Judd's criticism. But not all law enforcement agrees. Jacksonville's sheriff has voiced support for expanded deportation efforts, highlighting a divide across the state. The result, inconsistent approaches depending on where you live. Closer to home, a major development proposal in Sarasota County could bring more than 5,700 homes and a town center. The project, called Palmer Ranch East, is the brainchild of Hugh Culverhouse Jr. Its design would fit within the Sarasota 2050 plan. The proposal could be reviewed by the Sarasota County Commission as soon as June. As always, growth brings opportunity and questions about sustainability. And FEMA has approved a six-month extension of funding for temporary housing for survivors of Hurricanes Helene and Milton. Residents can remain in FEMA housing through October, with rent phased in over time. For hundreds of families, that means more time to rebuild and stabilize. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, March 18th.
Welcome. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. Sorry, my voice is a little hoarse this morning, but we have a wonderful guest for the first part of our show. But before I talk about that, remember that the views and opinions expressed by the hosts or the guests or the callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. Our guest this morning is Katie Sanders. Katie is the editor-in-chief of PolitiFact. It's spelled PolitiFact, all one word, at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Katie oversees PolitiFact's nonprofit fact-checking newsroom and its Pulitzer Prize-winning website. She oversees partnerships with local and national newsrooms and regularly teaches fact-checking techniques to journalists, social media influencers, and students from around the world. She's a past president of the Florida Society of Newspaper Editors and previously worked at the Tampa Bay Times covering state politics. She's a graduate of the University of Florida, and where she majored in English and journalism. Welcome, Katie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
I'm proud to have you. I've heard a lot of, I've used PolitiFact for years, but I want to mention one thing in case the time gets away from us. The Poynter Institute will host a seminar called Truth on the Line next Tuesday, March 24th, at the Selby Public Library, downtown Sarasota. The event begins at 6 p.m., and it'll include a discussion about journalism, misinformation, political pressure, and the role of accurate information in public life. More information is available at poynter.org. That's P-O-Y-N-T-E-R.org. So, Katie, tell us all about PolitiFact. And the website, by the way, is politifact.com, P-O-L-I-T-I-F-A-C-T.com. Go ahead.
So happy to. So we were established in 2007. So we have some serious legs in the digital space. We've been around for a long time. And we are a national nonpartisan fact-checking newsroom. And so that means when politicians like the president or leaders of Congress make statements in speeches or in TV ads during election years, we are the ones who look into it. We explain to voters whether what their leaders are saying is true, not true, pants on fire, false, or somewhere in between, which is one of our most common rating used to be half true, which means the statement's partially accurate, but is leaving out context. So we're well acquainted with the many ways that politicians shade the truth to try to, win people over to their cause. We check both sides. And we cover the news of the day, and it's a lot of fun. And I should say we also do it at the state level here in Florida with partnerships with many outlets across Florida.
Oh, the same website, the fact checks?
Yes. We post it at PolitiFact, but it's also at PolitiFact.com/Florida.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that. Okay, keep going. Tell us how you do it, how you do all of that.
Apologies if I have to mute for a minute and cough. So we have a newsroom of about 20 people.
Wow.
And Yeah, we've grown. Just a little bit more history. We were founded as a project of the St. Petersburg Times, now the Tampa Bay Times. So up until 2018, we were working as a bureau in the Tampa Bay Times newsroom, which is where I came up in journalism. And the project was successful right off the bat. They won the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting.
Wow.
First website to ever win the Pulitzer Prize.
Wow.
Back.
Wow. Congratulations.
And so from there, the newspaper thought, wow, this is really working. Readers really like it. We are making an impact. So they decided to keep it, even though it was supposed to be a temporary project just for the 2008 election. So we've covered many elections since, obviously. And I think that the role of fact-checking has really expanded. More outlets are doing it. Still not nearly enough.
Uh-huh.
But it's expanded to not just account for politician speech, but the role of misinformation online. And so PolitiFact has also grown and tackled a lot more of the information that you see on your social media feeds, on Facebook, on X, on TikTok. And a good chunk of our team is well acquainted with the ways of artificial intelligence and out-of-context images and manipulated media.
Yeah.
That is doing as much work as politicians to inform and sometimes mislead the public.
I'm wondering how you can keep up, with all the misstatements with the current administration that they sometimes come out two or three a minute. How do you choose which ones to check?
Well, we're looking for statements that are checkable, first of all.
Okay.
So that takes out a lot of statements off the bat.
Okay.
Just because a politician says something's bad or something's dumb or someone is dumb.
That's opinion.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't check opinions and we don't check predictions because no one really knows, right?
Right.
But so we pay very close attention to literal words of claims that are being made to see, can this be measured? And so that helps us narrow our focus. But, in today's climate and with today's president, there are just a lot of claims made in a single speech,
right.
And it would take days to untangle all of those claims, and it would really overwhelm the readers.
Right.
So we try to be particular about, is this checkable? Is it interesting? Do readers want to know the answer to whether this is true or not? Is this top of mind?
Right.
And is it on the news? Is it newsworthy? And so even with those criteria, we've narrowed down our choices, but there's still so many choices. So we're just thinking about, okay, well, then what is potentially most harmful if we don't step in and fact check it to provide answers? So we have some frameworks, but, journalists, nonpartisan journalists use their news judgment and try to apply it very fairly, very carefully. We want to make sure we're not piling on one side.
Yeah.
We want to make sure we're kind of equally monitoring the sides of the political debate so that everyone's getting equal scrutiny. So that does mean that there are some statements that go unchecked, but hopefully they're not the most important ones.
So each staff member probably researches certain claims and so forth. And I think you need three of them to get together and agree on a rating. Is that right? How do they arrive at a rating? They argue about it?
Yeah, this is a core part of the PolitiFact process. So a reporter will get the assignment and start digging into whether or not it's true. So sure. It might be a statement about the Save America Act and its rules for military IDs or, where you have to register to vote, things like that.
Sure.
It's a single focus statement. It's narrow. So the reporter will talk to experts, will review primary documents. We're trying to find out as much information for ourselves, not leaning on what has been reported by others, right? Mm-hmm. And so the reporter will propose a truth-o-meter rating. Mm-hmm. And so the truth-o-meter is what PolitiFact invented to reflect the accuracy of certain claims. There's six different ratings. The reporter proposes a rating, but it's up to three editors mm-hmm. to review the piece. And then then we have what we call a star chamber, which is just a goofy terminology.
Right.
But we have a meeting, usually on Zoom, because we work in different places, mm-hmm. to talk about, okay, we've laid out an argument, a reported argument for mostly true. And we go one by one and say, what do you think about that? And so we have a debate and we look at the definitions of each of these ratings that have been gently modified, but really like established over many years, right? We haven't modified definitions in a long time, maybe like 12 years, 13 years. I'm kind of making that up, but they've been around for a long time. And so, and one editor might feel, you know, this has more missing context than mostly true. I think this is half true. Another editor might say, but I think it was just a little bit of clarification that's needed. The statement's mostly accurate, but just needs a little clarification. So we kind of go back and forth so that until a majority of us are comfortable, we don't need a universal approval of a rating. We need a majority approval. These conversations are very civil. Mm-hmm. We are, you know, relying on the evidence that's been provided from subject matter experts and mm-hmm. All kinds of sources. But it gets complicated. But what I've always loved about PolitiFact, and I've been on staff since 2012, mm-hmm. is that we try to keep the language of our reports as accessible as possible.
Yes, so you do. Yeah,
we want it to be fun to read because we don't want to just give you policy vegetables. We want to like make it exciting for people who are curious about how politics works.
So the ratings go from true to pants on fire. Explain maybe quickly each one, each one would be given to a statement. True, of course, is just true, right? And then what's the next one down?
True means nothing significant is missing.
Right.
Okay, so that's a pretty rare rating.
Okay.
Because, yeah, sometimes we don't do a lot of obviously true statements.
Okay, mostly true is the next one, right?
Mostly true is the statement's accurate but needs clarification or additional information. Mm-hmm. And if I can, I will pull in some examples, but I'm going to have to pull up the PolitiFact website and think about that for a little bit. But I'll do that in the background.
Okay.
and then we have half true, which is the statement's partially accurate, but is omitting kind of critical context. And that used to be before we did a lot of like conspiracy theory checking on Facebook. That was one of our most popular ratings. I mean, I think that was the most popular rating, which we thought was kind of not that sexy, but interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, that like most of the time, I think you can interpret that as most of the time politicians aren't straight up lying to you, mm-hmm. but are, you know, shading the truth in ways that are a little strategic and hard for most people to really like know.
That's the mostly true we're talking about.
I was talking about half true.
Half true. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So a good example of the half-true claim, we've done a couple recently. The energy secretary of the U.S., Chris Wright, he said the U.S. produces more oil than we consume.
Right.
We're a net oil exporter. And so he was trying to make the case that, like, look, don't worry about what's going on at the Strait of Hormuz.
We got all we need, right?
The U.S. is fine. We only get a little bit of oil from there. We produce more oil than we consume. And when you dive into the details, there is some technical accuracy here, but the prices in the U.S. are still greatly influenced by what's going on internationally. And although we do produce a lot of crude oil, it is not clear that we can meet our consumption needs on our own. And a lot of that has to do with the type of oil that we produce where it can be refined. So we rated that half true. There was another statement from a Florida gubernatorial candidate that we rated recently from James Fishback. He's a Republican seeking the governorship. And he is, you know, trying to stake opposition to artificial intelligence data centers. And so he said they drive up electric bills by 30 or 40%, suck up 500,000 gallons of water a day. So we looked at the numbers. We kind of found that, yeah, they suck up a bunch of those things, electricity and water, but we couldn't find specific sources saying 30 or 40% electricity bill increases. And so the water target was a little bit more, was a little bit closer. But we rated that half true. Some information wasn't checking out there.
And then on down to,
mostly false.
Mostly false.
And so, yeah, mostly false. That used to be called barely true back around the era where I was joining. And I remember early into my career here, there was the editors at the time were like, barely true still has the word true in it. And that doesn't seem to really convey how wrong it is.
Good for you.
So they changed the definition to mostly false. And so when I was alluding earlier to, you know, these definitions being pretty set in stone, I was thinking about that. So mostly false means the statement contains an element of truth, but ignores critical facts that would give a different impression.
Right.
So an element of truth, but is really misleading. And so mostly false, we kind of think of like, okay, well, that's our misleading definition. It's like,
okay,
yes, this is right. I'm going to work on finding an example of mostly false. But I hope that people kind of understand why we would rate something mostly false rather than false.
Gotcha.
You know, it's not common parlance, but to us it makes sense.
And then there's just plain false, which is all wrong, right?
The shortest and sweetest definition. The statement is not accurate.
Okay.
Yes.
And then finally, pants on fire, which I love. You invented that. What qualifies? It's a ridiculous claim somehow, right? What?
Yeah, you get the word ridiculous in there. The statement is not only not accurate, but it makes a ridiculous claim. There are some fine lines between mostly false, false, and pants on fire. And that's why we have that council. I'm using these really distinguished words, but that's why we have these Zoom conversations for each of the ratings. It's not one person's decision. We gut check them with a team of editors who, with the reporter, talk about what we think is the fairest rating for the statement. And we also compare it with how we've rated similar things in the past.
Oh, sure.
So that we stay consistent.
Sure.
And we have always made that one of our last things to check off before publishing to make sure we are not just rating this in a vacuum, but we're considering it against the 30,000 other things we've fact-checked over the years, loose estimate.
30,000. Wow.
Loose estimate. I need to update that estimate, but I think the years go on and I haven't really updated the estimate.
Sure.
You know, it's important for us to not just consider things fresh each time. We like to look back and see, well, we rated this claim about the new Iran war this way, but how do we rate a similar statement about ISIS in 2014? These are real conversations we've had just the last week. Yeah. So we take it seriously. And we actually use a tool that was developed at Poynter to help us that uses AI, uses like AI analysis of our database to tell us very quickly how that statement compares with similarly rated statements in our archive.
Oh, that was one of my questions. Do you use AI at all? If so, how? So it can help you with your database and help you be consistent. What else? What else can it do for you?
So we have a faculty member at Poynter who specializes in AI. His name's Alex Mahadevan. He's also the director of MediaWise. And I was telling him over like lunch or beers, one or the other, that we rely on our human brains and the people who've been on our team the longest to tell us how do we rate similar statements? Like, oh yeah, I think that came up in 2016. So it's an imperfect human system.
Sure.
And so Alex created a tool that leverages our archive and just basically recommends rating based on how we have drafted a story. And we don't depend on it. We don't let the robot make the call by any means. We would be deeply uncomfortable with that. But what it's looking for is, like, does our argument make sense for the rating that we've proposed? If a robot is not following our logic and is not following our and is looking out for how we've rated similar things in our database, it's kind of a red flag if it's not checking out there, right? So we use that as a point of information, but we don't use it to substitute our ability to reason as humans, if that makes sense.
Well, I was going to ask, could AI ever do your work for you? Could you tell it to examine the statement? And I mean, is it possible, or is this really a human judgment thing?
I think it's a nuanced answer. So I think what AI has shown on something like Grok or other numerous programs that have been created is that AI can do a decent job sometimes at searching the web extremely quickly, processing that information and giving you an answer. Is it the right answer? Maybe sometimes, because something's been fact-checked really widely, and people will say, like, Grok, is this true? And it will give you a summarized answer. And sometimes it's kind of right. And to me, as a human fact-checker, I'm like, ooh, that's alarming. It's really good. Sometimes it's terribly wrong, embarrassingly wrong, pants on fire wrong. It's, you know, people are asking it to verify images from Iran, and Grok is just is kind of labeling things as AI, and it's not.
Got it.
Or the reverse is also true. So I do think that the technology is developing crazy fast, and it will probably only get better, right? But a lot of the information is relying on analysis done by human fact checkers on a number of topics. So I don't think that we are out of jobs, but I do think we need to be thinking about how we can, deliver answers faster, and make sure that accurate information is being promoted to people at the highest level.
Do you still have the flip-o-meter and the Trump-o-meter? Do you still have those too?
Yes, and then mostly yes. So the flip-o-meter is a pretty rare tool on our website. It measures a candidate's change in position.
Right.
And so we have a few ratings. You know, the candidate did not change their position, no flip. We don't use that a lot because normally we're breaking out the flip-o-meter to assess a change in position.
Sure.
But sometimes people are falsely accused of changing their position, so they might get a no flip once we look into it. A half flip, which is a partial change in position, and then a full flop, which is a total change in position. And we used the flip-o-meter recently for President Donald Trump's approach to regime change in Iran. And so we documented over more than a decade of statements, more of a decade or more of statements from Trump talking about that not being a wise approach, and then showing how that was contrasting with his current approach to Iran.
Do you have a Trump-o-meter anymore, or a special meter for Trump, or is that not necessary? Oh, you do?
No, we do. We do. So we have been we've been specializing in promise tracking since the Obama years. And we've done it for some governors, including the Florida governors. But for the presidents, we have thought that's really important to not just cover what they say during the campaign, but to remember what they promised and assess them on whether they're delivering on what they promised. We don't take a value judgment on, you know, supporting or opposing what they promised, but we want to provide answers to people about how that agenda is coming along. So during the Obama years, I think they had around 500 promises they were tracking, because Obama's promises were extremely detailed policy papers on space,
sure.
You know, and it was just a different candidate, different time. We invented the Trump-o-meter to assess Trump's promises. I think we tracked 100 or so from his first term. We also checked Biden's promises. on the Biden Promise Tracker. All of this is still on our website and available for people to scan. Mm-hmm. But we decided to create a new Promise Tracker for Trump's second term because he was making a lot of different promises. So we call it the MAGA meter. Oh. M-A-G-A dash meter.
Okay.
And you can find this on our website. I think it's on a sidebar called Most Recent Promises. Mm-hmm. And so the most recent state, we updated all of his promises ahead of the State of the Union address so that we could kind of give a snapshot of how he's doing so far. Mm-hmm. And the most recent promise that we assessed was his promise to restore and expand a travel ban. He promised on day one, I will immediately restore and expand the Trump travel ban. And that's a promise kept because he has done that.
Can people just sign on and search for a particular subject on the website, on your website?
Yeah, you can search by state. We don't cover every state, but if Florida is not your home state, you know, you might be interested in our fact checks on New York or North Carolina. Some of our states are busier than others, but we are also going to be shaping up a lot of midterm coverage on states that are in the Northeast with partners up there. So tune in this election year for sure. You can also search by rating. Some people just want the pants on fire. They just want to what have we lit up recently?
Gotcha.
You know? So, and you can also search by speaker.
Okay. So that was, and you had Pundit Fact.
Yes. Pundit Fact. So Pundit Fact looks a little different. We created that in 2013 to fact-check TV and radio talking heads, and I think we would expand that to podcasters and internet personalities in this day and age. And I think the pundits we check the most tend to be those internet influencers these days.
Sure.
You know, Benny Johnson, those kind of folks who are really planting a lot of seeds that people see online and have tremendous influence. So we do pay attention to how people on the left and right, or even like kind of like more liberal groups like Midas Touch or Occupy Democrats and their counterparts on the right, because they influence public opinion online. So we think it's important to keep an ear there. We don't always call it Pundit Fact. We had a really robust team of three people.
Sure.
For us, that's very robust, back in 2013 through 15. But now, like, any one of our staff can do a Pundit Fact item, essentially.
Do you? I wondered about kids as they're growing up in school, learning about current affairs and so forth. Do we teach kids in school how to fact check their sources or how to think about it at all? Is there a program you have for kids?
Yeah, well, so PolitiFact doesn't do a lot of school outreach, but at the Poynter Institute, we have this organization called MediaWise. And so we collaborate with them often. And MediaWise provides a lot of curricula for schools and librarians, teachers to bring into their classrooms to help students be smarter online consumers by learning how to, you know, just be more skeptical of what they're seeing online and how to research it so that they're not falling for the first meme they see with an enticing claim. And then we also partner with student teen fact checkers who will walk their peers through their own fact checking process and will break down how they figured out a claim was false. And so we've been doing that for many years. And so that's MediaWise. And folks should look into MediaWise on the Poynter Institute website, poynter.org, for more information.
Okay. I was going to ask you about MediaWise. I read on your website a partnership with TikTok. Is there something still going on there with them?
Yep. So PolitiFact has a history of partnering with tech platforms to help them identify false information on their platforms. We used to do that with Facebook, but we did that for about 8 years with Facebook after the 2016 election. But they stopped that U.S. program in January 2025. But we've had a partnership that is similar with TikTok since 2020, where we provide information about videos that they believe may contain misinformation. So a lot of this is about like health cures that may actually be harmful and not truthful, or conspiracy theories, or, you know, a lot of hoaxes about things going on in the world. before anything's really known. So yes, we're partnered with TikTok to try to improve information integrity on that platform. And we've had similar partnerships with others.
Great. Great. We're talking to Katie Sanders, editor-in-chief of PolitiFact, and the website is politifact.com. It's part of the Poynter Institute. Well, let's talk just a little bit. We have about 5 more minutes. Talk about the Poynter Institute, what it does, and that website is pointer.com, P-O-I-N-T-E-R, I'm sorry, .org. What does the Poynter Institute do?
Well, Poynter classically is a place where journalists can go to improve their craft of reporting, writing, editing, coaching writers. And it is the owner of the Tampa Bay Times newspaper, founded by Nelson Poynter about 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we've really expanded our mission to not just educate journalists, but educate the community about journalism and about a lot of the themes that we've tackled here about becoming better online consumers and more savvy about navigating the information that they're getting in the world. And so we're not only serving journalists, but also serving the public. And so we do a lot of community events to educate the public about what's happening in the news and we want them to better understand how journalism works, because journalists get beat up a lot. And a lot of our, we're often dismissed as partisan or hacks who don't take time to gather those facts and that information. And the reality and the truth is the exact opposite. Journalists are working tirelessly to confirm facts and, hold people accountable at the highest standard, right? So we've been talking to ourselves for a long time about those standards. And I think Poynter is a great megaphone for promoting the quality of those standards, not just to the industry, but to the public.
Well, you certainly got plenty to deal with all the different online services. And we know kids spend a lot of their time online. It's not healthy for them. We showed a movie here at film here at Fogartyville about the video, the social media effect on kids. And I hope you can keep on helping us make our way among those services.
Can I say, it's not just kids that we're trying to help.
Yeah.
I think MediaWise started as a middle school and high school initiative, but we recognize that everyone needs these skills. Seniors, all generations are kind of lacking in these skills, and we want to help inoculate the public against falling for scams and conspiracy theories. And so we train everyone.
And MediaWise, how do people access that, or how do they get that training? Is it online?
It's online. Yes, okay. You can go to pointer.org, P-O-Y-N-T-E-R.org, and go to media literacy. There's a tab at the top.
Okay.
There's a fact-checking tab, but there's also a media literacy tab. And from there, you can scan, AI literacy if you're concerned about falling for just wholly invented content. We also have programs in Spanish for seniors, for teens, and librarians. So they're really taking care of a lot of different people over there at MediaWise.
Okay. I think we're done here. I appreciate your time. Appreciate what you do. I hope people go to your website, politifact.com. Or is it org?
It's politifact.com. Yes.
Okay, great.
And sorry to make things confusing.
Okay.
Just Google PolitiFact.
And we'll see you next Tuesday night at 6 o'clock at the Selby Library, downtown Sarasota, and where you will talk about Truth on the Line, and about journalism, misinformation, and so forth. Thank you. Thank you so much, Katie, for your time, and congratulations on the job you're doing. Katie Sanders is editor-in-chief of PolitiFact at politifact.com. See you next Tuesday.
Looking forward to saying hi in person, and hope to meet anybody else who's listening and interested.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our next guest is Mark Edgington. Mark, unmute yourself. And did I pronounce that name right? Edgington? Is it soft?
You did. Okay. I'm surprised, in fact.
Okay. Edgington, and Angela McArdle was going to be here. Is she not coming today, or is she late?
Is my understanding she's on her way.
Okay, great. Mark is...
It's just a minute or two until we're scheduled to be on, so...
Okay. Mark, you can tell as a former radio host, you can tell by that voice. I'm not. I'm just an old Southern boy. But Mark is a member of the WSLR Board of Directors. He's also a libertarian.
Huh? Do you know how you find, figure out how a person is native to Sarasota?
I give up.
They'll tell you in the first 5 minutes, I'm a native of Sarasota.
That's true. I remember the old high school, the old Bayfront, everything. I came here in 93, so I'm a sort of half member.
As far as I'm concerned, that's native. If you've seen the changes, you've been there 30 years, as far as I'm concerned, that's enough.
Mark, you're a member of the WSLR Board of Directors. Am I right about that?
This, and I'm proud of it.
Okay. And you're also a libertarian, a former radio host with more than two decades of experience in broadcasting. You've co-hosted Free Talk Live, a nationally syndicated program on over 200 stations at one time. You ran for the New Hampshire House as a Republican and a libertarian in 2024. Your website is markedgington.com.
And I point out, I also ran for town moderator of Hudson, and I did, I think it was in 2024 also, and won that one.
Okay, let's talk about criminal reform and so forth.
Let's talk about it. I'll get everybody up to speed.
Sure.
I'm a convicted felon, and right. I'm not happy about it. It was way back in 1988. I was a place I shouldn't have been, and I was hanging out with people I shouldn't have been hanging out with. And the result, and when a man got killed in Bradenton, Florida, mm-hmm. and I was there, mm-hmm. and my worst mistake was when I talked to the cops, I lied. I tried to cover for my friend who had killed a man, and that went very badly. So I ended up spending 8 years in a Florida state prison. So I have a lot of experience in this particular area.
We want to talk about that. It's eight out of 25. I'd like to hear how you shorten that. It's probably a process you had to go through. So you wrote, as you just said, in one of your columns at marchedgington.medium.com, you wrote, at 17 years old, I made a terrible mistake. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And because of that, I spent my 20s behind bars. Formative years, most people spend building careers, relationships, and families. I spent mine learning how to live with myself. And it ends up owning my past doesn't mean excusing it. It means living with it, building from it, and refusing to let it be the only thing that defines me. I like those words. That's a very fine attitude. So tell me how you dealt with prison life, how you got out, and what you've done since. And let's talk about how we can improve the prison system.
I love talking about that particular topic because it's something that's sort of actionable. And everybody wants less crime. You know, there's nobody out there that's like, more crime. But, you know, there's one side of the political team, right, that likes to vilify the other side of the political team as though that's really the case. And it's absolutely ridiculous. So I say that taking what we are going to call for this purpose bad people, mm-hmm. putting them in a bad place, treating them badly, guarding them with what is generally considered also bad people,
yes.
at the very least highly cynical people, and then, you know, releasing them on the world as though things are going to be good is naive at best.
Right.
It's a crappy system. And I think that there are better systems, that we can get. Now, will there be mistakes along the way to getting to a better system? I'll bet there are, but there's mistakes now and we don't, you know, chop the heads off of politicians for that. So I think that that's probably where I would like to start.
I wrote down a few of the conditions. I've had guests talk about criminal justice. I've had this program for like 12 years, and they talked about the conditions inside, frequently new air conditioning, crowding, so forth, abuse by the guards, drug availability, video or phone calls, which are hugely expensive and hard to get, remote locations far from the family, which kills your family relationships, frequently there's no access to further education. There's a no comp time, inadequate comp time for good behavior. Then we could also talk about cash bail, which I think is a problem, because when I visited the jail here in Sarasota, they said 2/3 of them were there innocent, that is to say, before trial. So there's a lot we could fix about this. And I know you have a couple of favorite organizations here in town. So talk about some of that.
Yep. So first off, one of my favorite organizations, Project 180.
Yes.
They're really great. They help people.
Yeah, they've been on the program twice.
Yeah. They're so great. They help guys who want to make a change. And then that's what I believe the criminal justice system should be trying to do.
Yes.
Is trying to bring people to a point where they want to make a change. And you've got a window there when people want to make a change. Because if you keep them incarcerated for, 3 years, after the change, maybe 5 years after the change, then it gets harder for them to make the change. They get into this sort of institutionalized cynicism, which is unhealthy. And again, I'm not making excuses for criminal behavior. What I'm trying to say is that there's systems that might work better to limit the amount of criminality that there is in our society. And it's gone way down. We've taken lots of great steps since the 60s and 70s when crime was far more rampant than it is. And I think that there's more steps that can be taken, and that it would be relatively simple. And all sides could likely, reasonable people could agree on many of these steps. I'm not asking for, ridiculous ones. But you talked about comp time or gain time or any variety of these things. And I think it was in the 90s that politicians in Florida decided to get tough on crime. And one of the things they decided to do was to institute an 85% rule, where inmates needed to do 85% of the time that they were sentenced to. And this may on its face sound like a great idea. Lock up bad people, and then we don't have to deal with them. You do have to deal with them, by the way. They're about $60,000 to $80,000 per year to lock up. They cost more than they can make.
Right.
And they don't produce much of anything, by the way. If you think that prison labor is somehow out there doing something productive, you would be mistaken.
Maybe fighting fires in California. That's the only one I could think of.
It's a great one. There's no doubt. I think I support that program. I think it's a good one. I wouldn't hold anyone beyond their end of sentence date to do it.
Of course not.
And I think that there's lots of labor that can replace those guys. But, and nonetheless, I think that's a great program. When these guys are in for 85%, let's say you get one gets a 10-year sentence. That means that they must do 8.5 years to get out. I think it was a far better system to offer them, up to 5 years, maybe 6 years off their sentences in order to behave properly. Because really, do we want a system that keeps people housed and warehoused, or do we want a system that changes bad behavior?
Right.
And I hear the arguments on the other side. When people say that it is very difficult to rehabilitate somebody who's never been habilitated, I get it. Well, let's figure out what habilitation looks like, and let's try to do some of that habilitating, because that would be a really effective system.
Why should there be a limit on gain time or comp time you can get off your sentence when you do really good things in while you're inside? Why should there be a limit?
I don't see I don't think that unaccountable legislators know what that limit is, no matter what the limit is. I don't know what the limit is, but I don't think that they do either. As a person who spent, and let's talk about the gain time for the reason that I didn't do 25 years on a 25-year sentence. The reason that I took a 25-year sentence without taking it to trial was the gain time. The gain time was the whole thing. And then a Republican at the time, Charlie Crist.
Right.
He was just a legislator back then. He rode the Donald McDougal train. There was this terrifying man, whom I was incarcerated with at one point, named Donald McDougal, who killed his stepdaughter. But apparently there was some molestation involved and, you know, all kinds of awful things. This guy, his longest sentence was a second degree murder charge. And the legislators decided they wanted to keep him in no matter what, whatever they could do. So they began to take game time from everybody who had a second degree murder charge.
Oh man.
So, at some point, another guy who had a second degree murder charge, I don't have all the names in this. I didn't look it up for the purposes of this interview, but a guy paid another guy, and I guess this guy's name was Alba, and I can't remember if that was the first name or last name, but I think it sounds like a last name. He, and that Alba guy beat Donald McDougal to death with a shoe horse rod. So when you play shoe horses, that big stick that sits in the middle that you try to get the shoe horse on, he pulled that out of the ground and beat Donald McDougal to death with it. Suddenly the legislators didn't care about the sentences of second degree murders at all. And the Supreme Court ruled that they had taken the game time, unfairly. And that's how I got released. So I was released by an order from the state Supreme Court.
Hmm. Talk about, Project 180. They help you after you get out and even before you get out. Remind us what they do and how it helps. I know I've seen pictures of you with them at their galas. I've been one of their galas. They meet, if necessary, they meet the prisoner on the bus when he's first discharged, right? And they help him in a number of ways, him or her.
I can't say better things about this program. I really can't. So they begin to filter people before they get out,
yeah,
as to which ones they want and which ones they don't. Now, I never had the advantage of Project 180. It didn't exist when I was released in 1998. And I had my own path set up and what I was going to do when I got out. And I was very clear on what my goals were. And, however, these guys, it's difficult. The transition is very difficult. We limit many of these people in how they work, and insurance companies won't give people jobs, won't let employers take many people for many jobs. And I got out in 1998. We didn't have the internet to search, you know, every employer didn't get in there and check everybody's name or anything like that. And applications back then said, have you been convicted of a felony in the last 7 years? And the day I got out of prison, the answer to that was no.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So I'd been convicted in 8 years. So I pretty much could work any place I wanted
There's something called check the box, which we've been trying to get rid of, which on the application, you have to say whether or not, right, you've been convicted. And some people feel that's unfair.
Of a felony, yeah.
Of a felony.
I think that anything that exists within the marketplace is fair. However, it is a difficult thing to overcome. And when you just say, hey, look, all we're going to do with convicted felons is treat them like slave labor once they get out, maybe you're going to have some bad results. Maybe people are going to rebel against that. And do you want these people who have shown antisocial behavior in the past rebelling? And I say the answer to that is no. I think that we should make available to them as many jobs as possible. Look,
sure.
I wouldn't put pedophiles at nurseries.
Of course.
However, I do think that somebody who, you know, kited a check at 18 years old at 40 should probably be able to work anywhere they want, including a bank, so long as they've shown, you know, appropriate behavior. I don't think that we, the voting public, we, the democracy, even we, the politicians, none of these people have enough facts that sit in front of them to get involved in the relationship between the employer and the potential employee and decide who's going to be best for which job. Now, I say it's the responsibility of the employer to do the research and find out what they need to find out about a given person and decide. And my employers, in many cases, you know, found out and knew what my charge was, and they decided that I was a good enough employee that they wanted me to be there. And that's a decision they should be able to make.
Right. Another organization. And by the way, Angela McArdle has joined us. Welcome, Angela. She's a prominent politician, and I had your bio up here.
Well, I'll tell you this. Angela McArdle is the person who made the Libertarian Party relevant.
Yeah, she's the chair. She's chairs of the Mises Caucus Political Action Committee of the U.S. Libertarian Party. Obviously, Angela, we're not going to have time to talk to you and Mark about all of your activities. We're going to have you back at some point because I don't know exactly what libertarianism is. And then I read in Wikipedia there's a whole bunch of different parts or factions. And so it's a fascinating subject. And you guys could, of course, help explain it. But one more thing.
I've got one more little bit of factoid, Tom, that I want to throw out because I think this is so important for the listening public. 0.3%. We would all agree that that is an infinitesimal number and an insignificant number when we think about it. 0.3% of people are found not guilty at trial if you compare them to the set of numbers of people who are arrested. Which means that essentially a prosecutor decides the guilt or innocence of an individual. Now, this is our founding fathers would have literally lopped off heads over a system like this. And, you know, the people would have been tarred and feathered. Remember, the redcoats were found not guilty. John Adams is their attorney. They were found not guilty because they were considered to have acted reasonably. It was better that 10 guilty men go free than one innocent man is incarcerated. 0.3% of people are found not guilty at a trial. And that shows to me that the system has figured out how, over several hundred years, to essentially work its way in and put innocent people into prison. One more fact. About a third of people who actually make it to trial, one third of people who make it to trial are found not guilty. These are people who have been willing, in some cases, to sit in jail rather than take a plea bargain. In other cases, they've done everything within their power to get to a trial because they believe at the very least that they will be found not guilty. Now, I would suggest that probably more than half of them are in fact not guilty. But I think that we, the public, have just watched too much CSI, right? There's just, there's clearly, in many cases, a crime that's been committed, and we want a guilty party. And clearly there's some facts if these people are sitting there. But something's broken, and it needs fixing.
I also think our bail system is broken because only the Philippines and the United States have that cash bail system where if you have enough money, you can stay out of prison, keep your job, keep your car, keep your wife and family. But the people who don't have that kind of money or can't afford, and you lose 10% of your bond, you know, the people who don't have the kind of money to get a bail bond have to stay in jail for up to 7-8 months and lose all of the
three years
or years. There was a guy at Rikers. It's horrible. So, most countries don't use our bail system, and I'd like to know if you have any better ideas or what you would see prefer to see.
Yeah, I would prefer to see trials happen more quickly.
Okay.
So everybody just says that they waive this right to a speedy trial. Everybody in America has the right to a trial within 30 days. But your attorney will say this is a terrible idea. Why? I don't know. I think it's because he doesn't have the time. He doesn't feel like he has the time to prepare. But the prosecutors have the same lack of time to prepare. And the premise was that we can find something close enough to the truth to have a trial. And I think, I don't know if it's causation or correlation, but what I can tell you is in the amount of time that we have been, everybody's waiving the right to a speedy trial, the conviction rate that I was talking about has gone way up. So I think that those things are causative. That's causative. One's causative to the other, but I don't know that they are.
Don't you think we overdo it a little bit? We have more people in prison than any other country in the world. Right.
I think that's absolutely the truth.
I don't think we have more. Go ahead.
Well, another thing, is that if for whatever reason a police officer, a law enforcement officer, wants to find you guilty of something, they can do it.
Sure.
There's so many things that are illegal at this point. There's a book written called Three Felonies a Day. Now, I didn't read the book, but I love the title. And it suggests that every American is committing about three felonies a day. And it's, you know, fascinating when you start looking at these things. I remember that it was a misdemeanor in the state of New Hampshire to have a puppet show on a Sunday. And, you know, like there's just ridiculous things out there. Now, I suspect not many people have been convicted of having a marionette show on a Sunday recently in the state of New Hampshire. But nonetheless, there's just ridiculous things. One thing that I think that's worth pointing out that I'm terrified of is the violent felony called armed burglary.
Okay.
So they call this, right, it sounds bad, right? Like you go into somebody's house with a gun in your pocket ready to shoot anybody who gets in the way. But that's not how it's applied. The vast majority of armed burglars or somebody who went into a house saw something valuable in the form of a firearm, picked it up, and left. Now, it doesn't have to be loaded for this to be an accurate charge.
Wow.
And so many people are sitting in prison right now for what is called a violent felony, which... not so good. And they're there for stealing a handgun. And I don't think that that is what the people who wrote that law was the original intent of that law was. I think that was for somebody who came into a house with a gun on their hip ready to shoot anybody that they found.
We've got about five more minutes. Angela, did you, I apologize for ignoring you. You want to unmute and say anything about, yourself, libertarianism, or your work with Mark? I assume you work a little bit with Mark. Oh, I think she walked away from her computer. So, Mark, what are your projects now as a person? Are you just are you a blogger or speaker? What are you doing?
I work on the radio. I do podcast and a little bit of radio still, and happy to do it. It's always fun. But what I'd like to talk about is my work with Project 180.
Yes. Wonderful people.
I am a donor and a supporter of them, WSLR. I'm a donor to the news organization there because I think that local news is incredibly important, and really nobody's generating it in Sarasota. I work with, to some extent, St. Jude Children's Hospital, because I figure, you know, kids with cancer, you can't go wrong with that one.
Okay.
And lastly, a really important organization to me is called Foundation of Hope. It's in Jinja, Uganda. With the help of my radio audience, we built an orphanage there and bought them some land so that instead of going on the streets and begging, which is not a particularly productive thing to do in Jinja, Uganda, they can go on their farm and they can grow sugarcane and a variety of other vegetable crops that they can sell in the market or eat, you know, because the first thing you got to do with orphans is you got to feed them. So now they have a piece of land and they have a job and they have a marketable skill, and it's really just very rewarding, and we're very happy with what we're able to do. They built a school there on the land, and the kids are getting up to an elementary education so they can read and write and, you know, do those sorts of things, and I think that's important. And I'm just really proud of what we were able to accomplish there. I worked with a minister who contacted me many years ago. I'm going to just guess somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 years ago. And his name is Nafuna Johnson. It's an odd combination of names, isn't it? And he just really had a passion for these kids. He was one of them. He grew up an orphan in Uganda. And, you know, these were basically his younger friends, his charges, as it were, his wards. And they were sleeping in a shed when he contacted me. And it took about a year. We managed to use Bitcoin, actually, which my radio program, Free Talk Live, was the first media in the world to discuss Bitcoin. So we used the wealth that was created through Bitcoin to build this orphanage. And I think it has 20 beds or something like that. And not every kid that they call an orphan there is like without both parents. It's just like perhaps not the best parents, right? So it's a place for kids to go spend the night, get a meal. And if they want, they also have a job built in. There's some school built in. We, you know, raise money from the community and from, you know, Americans to keep the school going. It doesn't cost much to pay a teacher in Uganda, but it does cost. So we do that.
You've been there, obviously.
No, I've never been there.
Really?
I get videos and FaceTimes, and the kids will send me videos of them singing, they know my birthday, which is, you know, I would not have picked.
Well, but I hope you get over there to see the good you've done there. I think
it's a plan.
Documentaries. I remember one documentary, death metal in Ghana, but I would never have gone to the center part of Ghana and listened to death metal. But now I know a little bit about the subject. So, Thank you, Mark, for all you've doing and going to do. And thanks for the concern for the criminal justice system. We'll keep working on it. By the way, I think Project 180 has a dinner at Michael's.